Piccadilly Circle.
Well, I'd like to thank you for coming and attending our first Veterans Roundtable of 2012. We began this tradition, if we can call it a tradition, last year. A tradition has to start sometime. And we're expanding it to two roundtables this year, one today, and then one on Saturday afternoon at the same time, 3:45 in this room. So we'll be hearing from six of our veterans, and I hope that we'll do more of these as we continue our reunions. As you know, I'm Dr. Vernon Williams from the East Anglia Air War Project at Abilene Christian University in Texas. And what we're going to do is keep it very casual. I'm going to start down on the other end, and I want to ask the veteran to just state their name first, their bomb squadron, and their job at Thurlow, whatever it was. And then they're going to tell just some stories, some memories, a few things, and then we'll go to the next one and the next one, and then we'll open it up for questions and answers. Give you a chance to ask them any question that you might want to ask. Even it has nothing to do with the stories they told. The fact that they were a ball turret gunner, or they were a pilot, or they were a medic, or whatever it happens to be, may generate some questions that would be helpful for the rest of us to hear the question and the answer. So we appreciate your participation in this forum today. So let's start down there on the end and just state your name, the bomb squadron, and your duty, and then just tell us a little bit about your memory of your wartime experience.
Thank you, Bert. My name is Bob Schubert. I was a member of the 368th Bomb Squadron, of the 306th, and I was a tail gunner. That gives you my life story right there. I was young at the time of Pearl Harbor. I was only a freshman in high school at that time. So by the time I was a senior and 18 years old, and having taken some flying lessons, I determined that I wanted to be in the Army Air Corps. So I signed up in September of 43, and then I got called up in February of 44. And remind you, I was still a high school senior on the basketball team and everything. So I had quite a shock to find myself going to the Army. I lived through a very rugged basic training at Miami Beach.
And, tough duty.
And there, in those days, why pilots were a big number, what they needed gunners. And so I ended up going to Fort Myers, Florida for gunnery school. And then, believe it or not, I went to crew training in Chatham Field, just here in Savannah. And that's particularly why I wanted to come to this convention this year, because I remember Savannah and have so fond memories of it. Well, eventually, of course, we were flying over to England, the usual route from Bangor, Maine to Labrador, Labrador to Greenland, Greenland to Iceland, and then over to Wales. We arrived at Thurlow, where we were assigned, and our pilots and our crew had all of our training in a B-24. So we had to get readjusted, and we sat around as gunners for a month while the pilots got retrained. And in December of 43, we had our first mission. Now, because this was near the end of the war, why, things were a lot lighter. Not that the anti-aircraft guns were still pounding away at us, but we didn't have quite the fighter opposition that we had had years before. Now, at this point, I just simply want to say I finished 18 missions, and the war ended. But what I want to tell you about is my experience this past June. I went back to Thurlow as a member of the Greatest Generation Foundation program. How many of you have heard of the Greatest Generation Foundation? Oh, great. Well, I want any of you who haven't, and you haven't applied, I want you to be sure to give that some thought. Go online, TGGFUSA, and get their application. I had a marvelous 10-day trip, all expenses paid, and we, of course, went to England, back to Thurlow, along with three other air bases. Then, of course, we went over to Normandy, and that was an enormous experience for me to see the beaches of Omaha, and it was very revealing. And I must tell you, the French people really appreciated what we had done to liberate their small towns. All right, I think I've said enough at this point, and if you want any further information about the Greatest Generation Foundation, I'll be happy to tell you later.
Okay, we'll save questions to the end. Let's go on down to the next one.
Okay. My name is Alan Lawson. I'm from Beverly, Massachusetts, birthplace of the American Navy. That's why I went in the Air Force. I knew too much about the Navy. But anyway, I was a sophomore in high school when Pearl Harbor broke out. And as a matter of fact, I was listening to the program when they started to announce this, and I went in and asked my parents, where's Pearl Harbor? And they said they never heard of it. So everybody at that time was not aware of where Pearl Harbor was. But anyway, I was having a tremendous time in high school. I had a dance band. And my folks thought that I was having too good a time, and they packed me off to a small preparatory school in New Hampshire. And when I turned 18, I went down and, I'd been admitted to college, and I thought I was going to get a semester in at least, but I didn't. And I went down and enlisted in the aviation training program, cadet program. And I got sent off to not Miami Beach, but to Jenison Barracks, and was trained as an infantryman, and I thought I'd been sent to the wrong place. Then I began to think of this. When I was a cadet, just when I thought I was getting hot, we all did that, went through that. And I said, well, I better be careful. If I wash out of this, I'm going to do a lot of marching with a Garand rifle, because I had been trained as a rifleman. But anyway, I've completed my aviation cadet training and got sent off to Sioux City, Iowa. And on the troop train going there, I can remember the enlisted men that were going to be sent there. Well, at that time, we were in Nebraska, some bad place. But anyway, radio operator came back down through, and the crewmen were up there, were coming back through to see who the officers were going to be. And I can remember Joseph Marciano, my future radio operator, he came through and he sat down and said, he says, well, Lieutenant, he says, what's it like in the B-17? I said, I don't know, I never flew one. So his chin fell down and he got up and he went back. Because I never went to transition school. I got sent right from advanced training to a crew training. The reason being that they took my entire class and we were made the co-pilots for the class that was two classes ahead of us. And they had gone through their transition school. So we had to pick it up as we went along. But anyway, then I had the delight of being sent overseas on a troop transport with about 5,000 infantrymen. And there were three bomber crews on board. And by the way, we were the last bomber crews to join the 306 bomber group. I was 19 when I flew my first mission. And then eventually, the General Eisenhower decided that the 305th and the 306th Bomb Groups would represent the United States in Europe as the occupational air force, which meant everybody went home and we stayed there for another year because we didn't have any replacements. And they put us in the Casey Jones project. You might want to ask some questions about it, which turned out to be a very interesting run. Anyway, that's it.
Okay. Walt?
Okay, I'm Walt Rosette, and I guess I would start off, I was 18 in 1941 when the war broke out. I came to the conclusion whether I liked it or not, I was going to go into service. And I decided that it was better to be in the Air Corps than the infantry, so I enlisted and went in February of 1943. I had never been in an airplane before. But went in, went through basic training, and went through the testing process and whatnot. And then went to Lakeland, Florida for my primary training. Had a great instructor. The first time that we flew, we were using Stearman's PT-17s. First time we flew, we again weren't using runways, just an open field. And he said to me, I want you to put your hands up in the air and turn around and look at me. And I turned around and looked at him, and he had his hands up in the air as well. Reached down, pushed the throttle ahead, and the airplane wandered around the field, eventually took off. And one of the most important lessons you can learn in flying was, he said, if you just leave it alone, it'll fly itself. And after I had about 7.5 hours, and you get worried that you better solo pretty soon or else. And I was out shooting landings at an auxiliary field, and I made 2 good landings, and then made a lousy landing. And he told me to pull over to the coffee shack, which I dutifully did. And I knew he was going to chew me out. But he got out of the airplane and said, you're going to fly like that, go fly by yourself. And that's how I saw, that's how I saw it. And I, after I went through advanced training, I had decided in intermediate training, whatever it was, that I wanted to be a bomber pilot, not a fighter pilot. And after I got into advanced flying, why we looked at all of the airplanes, and I came to the conclusion that the B-17 was by far the safest airplane to fly in, and much better, much preferable to the B-24. Because if you ever had to land in the channel, if you landed in a B-24, unfortunately you were underwater, whereas I had a good friend who had to ditch his B-17 in the channel, and he managed to get out onto the wing of the airplane. A Royal Navy boat came up right next to the wing. He got out onto the wing, into the boat, without ever getting his feet wet. So it was a better airplane. I flew 33 missions. I had a slight wound in one mission in October of, I guess it was November of 1944, and never did get the Purple Heart then, but about 5 or 6 years ago, in trying to put my legacy together for my kids, I decided since I was entitled to the Purple Heart, I would get it, and we had a little ceremony on Veterans Day in Woodland, California, and the general came out and pinned the Purple Heart on me. It was good for laughs, anyway. I eventually became a lead pilot, and I don't know, some of you may have been at the meeting we just had in here. I was talking about a mission that we were dropping these Disney bombs on submarine pens in Vegasack. We had to make 4 runs on the target. The first run, we lost an engine. We did manage to, it was the only time that a lead airplane ever made 4 runs on the same target. And we did manage to get 3 of these Disney bombs, which were weighed 4,200 pounds apiece, one under each wing. We did manage to get three of them directly on the submarine pens. These bombs were designed to pierce 23 feet of solid concrete. They were doing 700 miles, they were rocket propelled, doing 700 miles an hour when they hit the ground. And I too was in the Casey Jones project for up until September of 1945. And we were down in Marrakesh in French Morocco. And when I wound up, I was assistant operations officer of the 369th. And that's my story.
Can I add something?
Yes.
During this time, he was my commander, and I was the grunt.
Now, Bill was not here when we gave the instructions, so let's sort of remind ourselves, and Bill is the next and last in line, and so Bill, we want you to get up and tell us your name and what your duty assignment was at Thurlai, and then tell us some memories of whatever you want to talk about.
Okay.
And then we'll have the audience ask all four of you questions.
Fair enough.
Okay? I'm glad Bill's here because
I see fighting there already. I'm Bill Carlisle, and I was flying control officer at the Thurlai Air Base. You may remember Bunny Hear Pilots. Do you remember skinny red-headed flying control officer? That was me.
Hasn't changed a bit.
I signed up to be in the cadets on the first ones that didn't need college. And they sent me to Santa Ana. And I got through primary, got through basic, and about 2 days before we were going to advance, I was playing volleyball with about 12 guys on each side. I went up, and another guy went up, and his elbow went in my head. I lost all my depth perception, so I washed out. And that was the best thing ever happened to me. Because my group went to the South Pacific, and they're still down there. And they sent me over to England. I spent 6 months with the Royal Air Force learning to be a flying control officer. And I ended up at Thurlai, which was great. Best place I ever was. We had one thing happened to me one night around the Battle of the Bulge. We sent, either a little before or a little after, I don't know, the weather was that usual nasty British weather we had, where we had mist and rain and fog and everything. And we got 35 planes back. There was one missing. So I was getting ready to fold up all the lights, because we had put everything up besides burning the hangars to get you guys down. And this plane was flying over, and I called it, and it was our lost hero. He had landed in France. They gave him enough gas to get back. And I says, fine, we'll have to divert you, because about that time my head was in the ceiling. And I could see about 100 yards down the main runway. Can't go. Why? I don't have a navigator. I don't have fuel. Now how was I going to bring those guys down? So I started playing with him. I told him to put his wheels down, because if I saw his lights, I was going to bring him in. Back and forth we went, and for some reason, God opened up one place. He was in the exact place to turn on base leg. I bring him around, he put his wheels up, and he belly landed. I come back in the tower. I was soaking wet. I'd been out there for about, how long did it take to land 36 airplanes at one time? Probably, an hour, half hour, something like that? I get back there, and there's a major in the tower. He says, Lieutenant, you did a great job, but you blew it. And about that time, I was a redhead, and I went right back at him. I says, Major, I says, I can tell him what to do, but I can't fly them damn airplanes for him. The other thing I want to tell you is, right after the war, were any of you there on when VD Day was? Remember when they lined us all up and I still have a hangover from that night. Anyway, on VE Plus One, I was the night duty officer, and during the that time of the year over in Britain, you have very little nighttime, maybe 3 or 4 hours. What was VE Day, May the 8th or something like that? Well, this would be May the 9th. So maybe the nighttime might have been 3-4 hours or something like that. And nothing was happening. It was absolute silence because we weren't allowed to do anything. So at that time, I wrote something. And this is what I wrote. After VE Day, the main of event is bent. The main function of a flying control officer basically came to an end. We were no longer called to help shot-ups come in for a safe landing, nor were we needed to make sure that the field was kept in top shape for those overloaded B-17s to get off the ground safely and into the forever seemed bad UK weather. The sudden stop in activity was, to say at least, quite a change during the rat race, from a rat race. Now, this is the part that I really wrote. Let me share with you what happened to me on VE Plus One when I was a night duty officer in the tower. That evening was one of the most beautiful I have ever seen and felt. By the way, I'd written a poem that time and I couldn't find a poem, but this is what it said. You could literally feel the beauty of the time. The late evening sunset seemed to linger on and on. The shadows quietly crossed over the field from the tower. Wait a minute. This is so old I can hardly see it. From our tower are a couple of new and shiny B-17s. And the light shining through the woods, that's where the bomb dump was, reflected an orange glow onto them. I was thankful that something so beautiful as a B-17 fortress no longer was used for war. Silence was around, no radio noise, no engines being tested, no trucks rolling by, just quiet. I remember seeing the birds playing in front of the tower. In all those days there, I never saw them, and God seemed to be saying, thanks that you mortals had finally stopped killing one another. And I think he was. Was I alone in these thoughts? No. I finally realized my radio operator was also standing and watching, and not a word passed between us. It wasn't necessary.
Bill, I'd like you to tell us who took over for you when you all left.
Ralph Porter. Ralph Franklin.
Now, we think of him as a 14-year-old, but his career was later at Thurlight as a flying control officer in the tower. Now, questions for these four gentlemen.
Explain the Casey Jones project, please.
Well, Casey Jones was doing a stereoptic map of all of Europe and the coast of Africa, Iceland, and places of that sort. It was a fascinating project because you had to fly at exactly 20,000 feet, couldn't vary more than a mile, which was very difficult flying at 20,000 feet, and you could actually look at this map that was being done, and if you had stereoptic glasses on, you could see the height of any object on the ground within 6 feet. It was really technologically for the time just a really remarkable project.
Was it a purely visual optical system that you were doing it with? Yes. No radar?
No, it was purely optical.
Well, originally they thought that they could use the bomb sight for, as if you were going from your, on a bomb run, both from point to point. That didn't work out.
So they didn't use bombs like that.
The only part of the bomb site, the part of the autopilot was underneath the bomb site, so we put it on the autopilot, but the pilot had to maintain the altitude. The navigator was up there telling us where to go. But he had the PDI, I thought, actually, to get this around.
After there was a photographer on that.
Can you guys keep your voices up?
As a poor coyote, as a camera. Oh, flying was mission.
These runs, you had to fly 200 miles in, that you did two runs of 200 miles each way. So it was kind of tough flying.
We knew nothing about photo recon, of course, but they took the gunners, I think they took them down to London and trained them for a week. And it was tough work, because these guys, in the B-17, in the radio room, there was another set of, we could call them little bomb doors, but there were little bomb full doors that could open in there. And they put in two cameras. One was for us and one was for the Brits, because they had a different format in their cameras. So these fellows had to learn to operate both of these. And the Brits did the same thing. They were on the northern part of Europe. And they had one of our cameras, and they ran that, so we saw it. I never saw one frame, did you? I never saw one frame of the stuff we took.
Now, speaking of logistics, you take off from Thurlow, as some of these target positions get further and further away. Do you always come back to Thurlow? Are your aircraft serviced at Thurlow? How did that work for you during the time you were with Casey Jones?
Oh, no, we always come back to Thurlow. Yeah.
You had enough fuel to...
Well, I mean, the 369th was down in Marrakesh in French Morocco. We were supposedly taking pictures of the coast of Africa, but unfortunately somebody didn't understand that the coast of Africa was always cloud covered in August. We never took any pictures.
We had one squadron at Gibraltar, one at Marrakesh, I think one in Casablanca, and one at Thurlow during the Casey Jones.
Portland, African coast.
Yeah.
There was another one at Istres. We ended up at Istres in southern France.
Did you?
Yeah.
When I flew back from Marrakesh to Thurlow, I had to drop somebody off at Gibraltar. And it was a fascinating landing because there's the rock there, and then the runway is built out east-west, but it's built out into the Atlantic Ocean and into the Mediterranean, and it was kind of like landing on a carrier. And there's always about a 30-mile-an-hour southerly wind, and the net result is you have to come in with the airplane pointed this way, and you hit the ground, and you've got to have a couple of engines on when you hit the ground, because if you don't, you're going to turn right into the rock. And when you come out the other end, you're facing the same problem. And it was a fascinating thing, taking off about an hour or so later, and you almost had to take off on two engines because of this wind. But obviously, we survived.
It's also the only runway I ever saw when the windsocks were pointing at each other. And when you rolled out onto the pier, onto the extended part of it, you were just off of the coast of Spain there. You rolled out on that, you could get away with one side here, then you had to turn around and come back. Now on the B-17, you don't spin on the one wheel. You always have to be rolling a little bit. So
yes. It
was a little bit tricky getting back around there.
May I add something amusing to that Gibraltar thing? After the war was over and all this down there, we were allowed to go down and visit Gibraltar. And I went down there and had my two or three days and came back. When I got to the plane, I was going to get in the back of the plane, like usually. And the commander of the 367 says, "We got a special place for you." They used to try to get us flying control officers, believe me.
Get even time.
Yeah. They put me in the nose in the bombardier's seat. and they taxi out on this runway, and he goes all the way down the end and straight off. Don't climb. Yeah. I mean, right down. And we climbed. I thought, my God, this guy's climbing fast. And we got up in the air about, oh, I guess 12 or 13,000 feet. We didn't have any oxygen. And we're buzzing along in France, and I'm standing up there by the pilot. He says, hey, Reds, get me a beer. I says, a beer? And I didn't know it, but we had a Bombay full of American beer. The party started. Believe me, it started. We were an hour and a half late getting into Thurlight. We drank a case of beer. You open a case of beer 12,000 feet, you only get half a can. Yeah. They decided, he says, you want to see a castle? I said, sure. And the navigator, the pilot says to the navigator, which way? He says, over there. I mean, the truth is, he actually said, over there. So we went over there. And this was this big thing where it was on the coast of France. I guess some of you guys have seen it. There's a big castle or church or something.
The
tide comes in, you can't get to it, and so forth. So we flew around that for a while, and we went out over the Bay of Biscay, and we found an aircraft carrier. And we were standing there debating whether we should make an approach on the aircraft carrier. You've got to remember, we've been drinking all this beer over there, see? And then we decided that was a bad idea.
You'd have to share your beer with us.
I'm going to tell you, I mean, this was one of the last flights I had in a B-17. And then they decided we would look at the invasion beaches. So instead of 12,000 feet, we're down about 100. Up the beaches, you know, and then we're back up. And finally, after fooling around a while, we landed. And everyone went, where in the hell have you guys been? And of course, we were half loaded. We didn't give a damn. The crew was going home, I was going home, and we were happy.
One more word about the runway in Gibraltar. As you came in, at the base of what you see on the insurance ads and everything else, actually faces in with towards Spain. That's not what's on the Mediterranean side. But halfway down there at the base is a cemetery. And there's a cemetery and then the runway and a little bit of flat land. And when you get about halfway, you look out, first time you go by the whistle blow, it's like going through a railroad stop because there are railroad signals that are down on the building. Yeah. But down and the car, there's traffic backed up on either side of them, going back and forth from Spain. And whenever a plane lands, they always have to cross, put these kits down. And then you whistle by, and then they had to hold them there, and you taxi back and got over on the place. By the way, if you ever land there and you go to the British mess, all you ever ate was mutton. Where's our friend?
Back over there.
Yeah, it's back over there.
Any other questions? Over here, let's take one from this side. Shell.
Yeah, my dad was a pilot with the 423rd Palm Neo. And it always amazed me how those guys at that young age could fly those missions. You know, what kind of courage they must have had. And you know, he was 23, so he was kind of one of the older guys, but I mean, they were so young. And I'm wondering, when you flew your first mission, how did you feel about that? Were you excited? Were you scared? You know, was it frightening or what? And did that change over time as you flew more and more missions? And then were you reluctant to talk about it for a long time afterwards, after the war ended? And anyone of you that? Anyone else?
Answer, but I didn't hear everything she said. Well, I think you mean the first mission?
Mm-hmm.
Really, you didn't really know what was going on. Because there was so much going on, one thing or another. And also, you know, we wore steel helmets. And if you're smart, you could pull that way down, you didn't have to see anything either. But no, you were so busy in the cockpit on the first mission, you didn't realize everything that was going on. Actually, that was my
experience?
My experience was, first of all, you flew the first four missions as co-pilot. And, or at least I flew the first four missions as co-pilot, so you had a lot more chance to look around and see things, etc. But my feeling on the first mission was that we had been trained extremely well. I honestly still marvel at how well we were prepared for combat when we went over there. You had a feeling of camaraderie with your crew. You all knew where you were going and what you were going to have to face. And I will say that when you were over the target, you were subject to the flak in particular, I think everyone was scared. There was no way to avoid the fear associated with seeing that black cloud of smoke, you know, maybe a couple hundred feet ahead of you, with the idea in mind that maybe the next one is going to be right in the cockpit of your airplane. But I think everyone felt pretty much the same way. You were fearful when you were over the target in particular, but you were well trained for it, and you dealt with whatever you had to deal with. And it was one of the remarkable experiences of my lifetime. It certainly had an influence on the rest of my life.
I would like to add my first mission. Like everyone, you're scared, but yet you're trained. You're going to do your best. And at age 19 and 20, nobody can hurt you. You're going to survive. But on our first mission, flying as a tail gunner, the plane to my left was hit, and I watched it as it bellied over and went down. And of course, we moved on. I couldn't tell if there were any parachutes or anything. And it was after the war when back at the base came a young man who had lived in my barracks, and he had been in that plane that was shot down and was able to parachute out and had been a prisoner of war the rest of the time of the war. But, you know, it's a happy ending, but for a first mission for a 19-year-old, it was a scary experience to see.
I have one story that I'd like to tell that I think everyone here should appreciate. On May 2nd of 1945, this is a week before the end of the war, there were no targets left to bomb, so we were delivering newspapers instead of bombs. And instead of flying with 1,000 other airplane at 20,000 feet, you flew this all by yourself right on the ground. And I mean 50 feet is what we flew at, because there was still the possibility of German fighters there. And you were much safer if you were close to the ground. The only altitude restriction they had was when you cross the Mannheim River at Ludwigshafen, you had to be at least 500 feet because there was a telephone wire they didn't want knocked down. But we were dropping barrel-like containers on parachutes, and the first target was Ludwigshafen. And I then went to the prison camp at Buchenwald that had just been freed 3 weeks earlier. And I flew around it for about a half hour. It was one of the most emotional experiences of my lifetime. There was the grave open with 1,000 bodies laying in it, and the survivors on the ground with arms like this waving to us. And if I could have got my hands on a German, I would have killed him. But it was the perfect way to end the war, because I don't know how many people I killed or how much damage I did on those 33 missions I flew. But whatever it was totally justified by what I saw that final day. And it was something that everyone here should feel good about. I will also mention that I took off on Christmas Eve in 1944.
And you didn't get back.
And I didn't get back, along with anybody else. This was the Battle of the Bulge, and they came to the conclusion they were going to get the 8th Air Force off the ground, or maybe they were going to have to get out of Europe, because we had been grounded for about 2 weeks because of the weather. And I took off that morning. I could not see the wingtip of the airplane. And there were more airplanes lost on takeoff that day than were lost in combat.
I was a duty officer that morning.
When we came back, there were only three airfields in all of England open. And we wound up landing along with 300 other airplanes at a base. And they, of course, had no place to accommodate us. We slept in the airplane. I kept an engine running all night because it was freezing. And we woke up in the morning, there was an inch and a half of frost on the airplane. But it was one of the eventful missions.
Yeah. Could I add something to that?
He talked
about landing away. We took off 50 planes that morning. There was that would be four squadrons, right?
Yeah.
And they sent them out, and when they had briefing, they told them to where they were supposed to land or land wherever they could. Now, after the mission was over, we sent 50 out, and one came back. He aborted. So we had 49 airplanes, and I think there was 14 different fields where they landed at. I got it upstairs, right upstairs. It's right out of this book, the log book of the control tower. It lists where all these airplanes were. And we got enough back to make another mission on the 28th of December.
Yeah.
Clifford?
For Bob over here, everybody knows how crammed everybody was in the ball trucks, but I finally saw the inside where the poor tail gunner got to sit, quote unquote. Can you tell me how you still have knees and explain what it was like to fly a 5-6-7 hour mission back there in the tail gunner position?
Well, it was tight. One of the things that we had on, besides a helmet, we also had a flak suit, and that weighed you down. And of course, you were sitting on a little bench about so wide, and maybe a little pad on it, but you had a choice of putting your feet out in front of you or squatting and sitting with your feet in back. One of the things that was a little scary about that was because you had this flak suit on, you didn't have room to put your parachute on. So I had to set my parachute on the side, and had I ever needed it, I would have had to pull off the flak suit, put on the parachute, and jump. And thank goodness I never had to.
Which way did you set your feet out, or were your feet back on the end?
Yeah, either way.
Which way did you choose?
Most forward, yeah.
Mostly forward.
How hard are those guns to shoot now accurately?
Well, having never hit a plane, I can't tell you.
In the hospitality room, I have a book that I bought because my uncle was a gunner that gives the relative accuracy based on what position you were at shooting 50 caliber, which was the most accurate. And believe it or not, the tail gun position was not the most accurate.
Yeah, remember too that the tail position was still a handheld.
Yeah.
He reached around a piece of armor plate and held it. Whereas the others were turrets. You have to throw it for ball turret. No, they're a little more accurate.
Anyway, they have a diagram in there of the various accuracy of the various positions.
Because the Mighty 8th Museum, they have that one machine gun there that you can try to shoot planes on a movie screen. It's a little interactive thing. So I didn't know how accurate that was or representative it is. Doing the real thing.
He mentioned a little minutes ago about we don't know how many Germans we killed in our bombs, but you have to think about something that happened to England. the Battle of Britain, and particularly the city of Coventry. Now, I went to Coventry after the war on a bicycle trip up there from Thurline and watched and saw this cathedral that had been completely bombed out. And I learned there that there had been 500 or more German planes that had bombed that city, a city that had no ammunition, no manufacturing, nothing in it except civilians. Over 1,000 people, British people, were killed on that bombing mission. So, any time that I feel badly about the fact that I dropped bombs on Berlin, I have no sad feelings at all.
Any other questions from back over here?
I have a technical question. My dad was a bombardier, and from what I've read, by the time he got there, which was the end of 43, they had the lead bombardier system. And so when the lead bombardier dropped the bomb, then the planes behind, then those bombardiers would drop. So did my dad use the Norden bomb sight and take over control of the plane like you read about? Was he, no?
No, only the lead bombardier dropped the bombs, and everybody else just hit the switch. And towards the end of the war, they were using what were called toggleers rather than bombardiers other than the lead airplane. The lead and the deputy lead obviously had to have bombardiers in them, but the rest of them really didn't need bombardiers.
They shot flares also when they dropped?
No, it was all visual. You just saw the bombs go and you dropped off.
Well, there wasn't even radio contact then.
No. As a matter of fact, we pretty much used radio silence, but every time you got over the target when you were in the 369th, you would have a fight, bite, and check-in. And all you heard on the radio was fight, bite, and fight, bite, and fight, bite.
Tell me about that.
Yeah. And there's nothing, you couldn't tell where it was coming from, so nobody was guilty.
Yeah, the Germans thought it was Navajos. Questions?
My memory is right. We used to drop the lead bombardier would drop, and then the alternate lead would be in number two position.
Yeah.
And the toggleers would wait and watch when his bombs came out. The toggleers would drop on his bombs. So there was one more point of safety if you wanted to stop it.
How often were you able to get into London to have some fun?
I'd say once a month. And we usually go as a crew.
A couple more.
Yeah.
And why did you do that?
Well,
it's kind of like Vegas.
They went to the library.
Next question. We would talk about
it. All I know is that all my trips across England in the last 10 years, I keep running into these women and keep asking about you guys. Do I know Walt Rosette? You know how I can find him.
You know the name of that group of women?
Yeah, the Piccadilly Commandos.
We used to have a rodeo in a tower. We had two frequencies in the tower. One was called a darky frequency, which everybody had. If it was plane got lost, you could call darky and they'd tell you where to go. And the other was the squadron group frequency, 5555, I think it was. And we were supposed to have about a dozen miles radius that you could use this radio. Ours was slightly larger. We used to talk to airplanes out over the wash. And that was, 100 miles away, something like that? Anyway, I was sitting in the tower one day after the mission came back, and here comes one of my buddies up. He's got a note in his hand. He says, "Hey, Bill, did you land such and such a plane at such and such a time?" I looked up the board, and I says, "Yeah, there he is." He says, "I was on the bombing run to Stettin, and I heard you." Skip distance.
What time of day was that? There was times when skip was more prominent than others, in like early morning and late evening. That's when the skip is more prominent, yeah. I think.
Bill, what years were you there?
Huh?
What years were you there?
What years? I got there in January 44 until the end, or just about the end. Maybe about 2 or 3 weeks before they closed up.
Now, Bill has donated the tower logs. We've reproduced them. He has copies of those, and we've scanned them. And the originals are now in the museum.
Are they?
But, yes. But those scans will be going up online where all of you could look and watch what Bill is writing each time he's on duty. They're a fascinating story of missions and weather and all those kinds of things. And very valuable tool in terms of trying to recreate a total picture of missions. And so with mission reports and all these other tools that you have, the tower logs also will add to your ability to understand the conditions of flight operations at Thurlow on a particular day.
When you logged it, when a plane was coming back in from a mission and they landed, what would you write down?
Well, you just say...
The pilot's name or the aircraft number? Or
like we might say aircraft 782 C Charlie was missing. Or we got all their aircraft down, everybody came back or something like that. We didn't, it wasn't the tower's ability or anything to say to put down in their logbook what went wrong. Or who was shot down. It's just that we sent out 36, we got 30 back. Missing were blah, 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 and then we put write it down, that's it.
Typically when we landed, you would fly a squadron over the runway at, I don't know, maybe 2,000 feet or so, and the low flight would peel off first, and he would turn around and come back into the runway. And then you would gradually work up through the entire squadron so that the entire squadron was landing at one time, and it'd be about, I don't know, maybe a minute apart.
Not that much.
And you're right, it may not have been that much. But, you know, a minute is, I guess, a long time when you think about it, but a 5,000 foot runway, if somebody has trouble in front of you,
yeah.
You really don't want to land 15 seconds behind them.
We tried to arrange it so when these, like he talks, the peel off of these airplanes, we would try to have three on the runway. It was 6,000 feet. One turned off, one in the middle, and one touching down. Now, if they had been on a long mission, lots of times there was like four of them, or sometimes five of them on that damn runway.
Yeah.
All right?
Yes.
Didn't have enough fuel left.
Huh?
Not enough fuel left.
That's right.
Spend a lot of time up there.
Any time those guys would land, and when it was a tail dragger, the props would stop, and they just coast off on the grass.
Now, I noticed in some of those tower reports there were some color codes used. Can you tell us a little bit about what green and red were?
When we first started, when I first got there, they were using a code for start engines and taxi and takeoff. Like you make cigarette care, you say Camel cigarettes, Lucky Strikes and stuff like that. And then we got to the point where we would fire a flare, meaning start engine. And then we would fire another flare, meaning taxi. And then the green flare means go. And coming back, of course, the red flare, and from them, a red flare meant they had wounded on board. For if we fired it, you'd go around again. Something's wrong. And I think that's about all we had, didn't we?
Yeah, I think so.
Clifford?
Well, the two pilots I'm curious as to the complexity of trying to maintain formation, or fly in formation when having just gone through and learned that you just don't run the throttles up and down, you had to combination of manifold pressure and turbochargers and RPMs and just the complexity of flying in these tight formations. What was it like? What were the duties of the pilot coach and the co-pilot? Was it really a tight teamwork type of thing?
I will tell you that flying formation, particularly in anything other, if you were flying off somebody's wing and you were on an 8-hour mission, when you came back from that 8-hour mission, you were absolutely dead tired. I have never been so tired in my life. And, you know, they used to give us a shot of whiskey when we came back. I could never handle a shot of whiskey when I came back because I was just too absolutely, totally dead, deadbeat from that pressure of flying 100 feet away from another airplane. It's one of the reasons I wanted to be a lead pilot.
I know we grunted. We flew off his wing.
There was one thing we did at Third Eye that we used to make, the flying control officer had to prepare a taxi plan for the takeoff. And they took off in squadron order, wherever you were, so it was much easier for them to assemble. And I asked one day why they did that, and I was told if they took off that way, they saved 15 minutes of fuel. Is that about right?
Could be, I've never heard
of that. Colonel Raper told me that.
Yeah.
That they'd save 15 minutes of fuel, which meant they had some fuel to go around again or something like that.
Yeah.
It was a good outfit, that 8th Air Force. They had a lot of ability to produce good formations, good returns. When they came back, you got to remember, when they came back, there were 2,000, sometimes 2,000 airplanes trying to come back in the size of Delaware.
Yeah.
And it was like everybody went to this point, that point, that point, and then they flew in corridors back to their air base. They had an amazing organization there.
I know it was better toward the end of the war, but after you hit the IB, went in, dropped your bombs, and made your turn, you had a marshal point after the bomb drop. Is that correct? Or were you able to maintain formation all the way?
Oh, no, we were always in formation over the target.
Yeah.
You broke the group up. The group, of course, consisted of 3 squadrons of 12 planes, and each of those squadrons bombed separately.
Okay.
So you then got the group together after the bomb run.
So there was a marshal for the group, but not necessarily the planes.
All of the planes were still in formation. And there was a kind of a major decision when you dropped the bombs. You know, if you're the lead pilot, you had to make a decision as to whether you made a turn or whether you gained altitude or what you did. And those decisions were probably as important a decision as you could make, because that's where the flak was. And the question was, how were you going to avoid the flak? And sometimes altitude would do it, and sometimes turning either right or left would do it. But that was a major decision at the time.
Question back there.
You never flew directly to the target. You flew to an IP.
Right. The IP ran in.
Yeah, then you had to turn on the target so that everybody was going the same way.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, question back here.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm a little naive with some of that. Was the formation different when you were, in route, when you're going there, compared to when you were in battle position, when you were dropping your bombs, or how would the planes line up? Were they all across, or in a pyramid, or can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, there, of course, is a formation up in the room over there that had been put together. But that was the early part. Our formations were 12 airplanes. You had the lead flight, which had 6 planes in it, the lead airplane and one flying below and behind it, and one flying on each of their wings. And then a high flight and a low flight of 3 airplanes each.
Oh, okay.
And then that was a squadron, and then you had three squadrons in the group. You had the high squadron, the lead squadron, and the low squadron. And over the target, you broke it up into the lead squadron went in first, and then the high, and then the low.
So you're flying 36 plane formations for the group. The squadron 36 plane formation.
Yes, 36.
Three squadrons of 12.
Right.
Yeah, the squadrons go to the trail.
Right, they would fly high, lead, and low, and then they go into a trail at the IV going over the target.
I'm curious, you were talking about how exhausting it was to maintain formation as a pilot if you weren't in the lead. What, just in layman's terms, what was so difficult? Was it physically difficult, just, or
well, it,
just
it was
mentally
physically difficult. You had one hand on the control valve and hand on the target. Oh, I'm sorry, on the throttles. And you had to be 110% of the time looking at that airplane that you were flying next to. So it was...
And just muscling your plane into a...
Well, I would say it was mostly mental strain. Physically, uh-huh. You know, the business of moving either the control column or the throttles was not a big deal. You know, particularly if you're 20 years old.
You just had to be focusing the entire time.
Yeah, but it was the mental concentration that was really the pressure.
See, the B-17 still had the control wires going directly like from your,
yes,
your rudder pedals. They went directly back to your vertical stabilizer and the rudder. And so if I could get to the B-20 now, and then they start getting into servo motors on the control so that you didn't have to physically pull. If you've been next to the 17, you saw how big that tail was. Well, you pumped that rudder back there, mm-hmm. and that was kind of tiring after a while. But with flew formation, I know with my pilots up there, JJ, we used to trade off every half hour. We'd fly a half hour, yeah. And we'd fly a half an hour. And whoever was flying flew, and the other one was watching the engine, taking care of the engine procedures that you had to do. So you kept trading off.
Why did you use other
hands? The book says we had to fly 50 feet off of the other guy's wing, so it was pretty close. Of course, it didn't always go that way.
Yeah, yeah.
But the book said.
Why did they use the other hand grip on the throttles?
Four throttles.
Well, there were four throttles, so yeah. You had, it was configured, well, you'd see pictures of the throttles up there, but there were two on the top. And then all four of them came together in the middle, and then two of them on the bottom. So I guess the top two were the two external engines, and the bottom were the two internal engines.
So,
but you had your hand around all four of the
throttles. So it's just easier to grip from an underhand position?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, that was the way you grip it. Yeah. Yeah, it wouldn't. It was much easier.
You could also jerky the engines too by your pan.
Yeah.
You could move those a quarter of an inch or so.
Yes, and you would move them gently. You didn't move them back and forth.
How difficult was it to keep the engine synced so that you didn't have horrible vibrations in the plane?
I don't think that was a problem.
You could. Actually, you could only hear your inboard engines.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
You could, because if you're flying twin engine, you know, you can synchronize them with using your ears. You know,
right.
Wah, 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 wah. And you could change the RPMs on them. We could do it on a B-17, but you only heard the inboard engines. So you never could sync the other ones. You had to use your engine.
Oh,
I had to do all the engine work for these guys.
Okay, so you were just having to use the RPM tachometer to keep tied together or sync together?
It's
Yeah, whoever wasn't flying the airplane was looking at the
Yeah, cars. Right, yeah.
How did you guys handle it when you're next guy over, you know, that didn't make it back? I mean, you're young men. I mean, they have chaplain or any kind of thing to try to help you guys, or you're just kind of on your own? You have to figure out how to accept it.
I didn't quite hear it, Charles.
When some of your comrades did not make it back, your young men, how did you handle it? Do they have chaplains, or you were just expected just to handle it? Push on through.
Just happened. Fortunately, I flew 33 missions. The 369th never lost an airplane on a mission I flew. So I never had that problem. But there were missions in between where we had losses, and you did have an emotional reaction to it, you know, particularly because that all of a sudden that bed was empty, and you knew it was empty, and it was empty for, you know, until they cleared everything out. And it was an emotional experience. You dealt with it.
You didn't have any help? You didn't have chaplains or anything like that?
Oh, yes, there were chaplains. And yes, I think that people...
Bloody.
I think that there was a little bit more religious orientation at the time than you might find today.
I have a question for Bill.
I can't go hard to hear.
Okay. My dad was grounded for a month, and his best friend, who was the navigator on his crew, was killed on a mission, and it was fogged over that night, and so the plane had to land elsewhere, couldn't come back to Thurlock. And so I've often wondered, how did my dad find out? I mean, I'm sure he was sitting there waiting at Thurlock for the plane to come back. So when would he have found out where the plane had to land and that his friend had been killed?
We usually got word that a plane would land in, shall we say, in France. That was reported through 1st Bomb Division, through the combat wing, and into the 306 Bomb Group, who would probably have told you what happened.
But this was at a nearby, you know, one of the other bases in England.
Yeah.
So should they pick up the phone and say, "Hey guys, we've got your plane," or?
Well, I don't know what matter how they did it, but if they landed at another, shall we say, 8th Air Force Base. Yeah, they just call us at the tower, and we would tell the operations, and they would, or the squadron, and they would know that X-ray landed at Shelviston instead of Thurlock.
What about a plane landing on your airstrip? Are you the one that called Shelviston?
Yeah, we would call, if we couldn't get the field, we would call the division, and they would take care of it for us.
I had mentioned this earlier. Talk about a mission that I flew with these Disney bombs, but we had lost an engine and consequently had used up much more gasoline, and we had to land at the first air base that we could land at in England, and it was a British air base. So it was just a matter of you needed a place to land, and we had at that point 5 minutes of fuel left. And if I had to go around, maybe we wouldn't have made it the second time.
That's right.
Did you have, when you took off, what the Navy would call bingo fields? If for some reason you knew where you weren't going to make it back to Thurlock, was there a set of ones close to the channel itself, like Thorpe's Abbott or Snudden Heath, or ones that were close to that one?
I'll try to answer that. Yeah. When they took off, if it was bad weather, they were briefed the possibility there would be a diversion.
Yeah.
And when they decided to divert the airplanes from Thurlock to some other place, I would have to sit down with the bomber coat and make out a thing and hand it, give it to the guy with the radio, who would call the, I guess it would be the group leader. And said, okay, you can't land at Thurlow, go to such and such airfield. The organization was magnificent over there in the 8th Air Force, believe me it was. If I may, the fields were so close that I could go on the top of our building, which was like two stories high, and I could see the airplanes at Kimball, which was about 6 or 7 miles away. When we had a mission in the 1st Bomb Division, I had to tell them what runway I was going to use. Because if I used another runway, I'd be interfering with another airfield. If the organization was magnificent over there, they'd take all these airplanes off, they would go to what they called a bunker, a radio place, they get in formation, then the third line planes would join the 40th Combat Wing, 40th Combat Wing would join the 1st Division, the 1st Division would divide the join the 8th Air Force, and away they'd go. It would take them 2 hours from the pass point over, going off of the English Channel. The organization was magnificent over there. You had no idea how much you could pick up the phone and call somebody in Scotland, and you'd get them just like that.
What about other questions in the audience?
One last one for the governor. They were asking about the shooting of 50 cal back then. Did you ever have a gun jam on this? Did you ever have the gun jam?
Oh, no. No, nope, it always worked.
Good old Brian.
We're always pre-fired, going over the channel, to make sure that they were working. And they always worked for me.
I flew one mission. This was, I think, in November, December of 44. I was flying in the number 4 position, right behind the lead airplane. And when, as he just indicated, when you got over the channel, you brought the live ammunition into the guns. Well, one of the gunners in the lead airplane cleared a couple of live shells out and hit my number 2 engine and set it on fire. I, of course, feathered the engine, dropped the bombs in the channel, and went back to the base. And the fellow that filled my place in was shot down. One of those things, if you have to choose between lucky and smart, choose lucky.
We had a mission in early 1944 that went to Norway. They're going to buy a heavy water plant up there. And they're going on, they got up to whatever altitude they were. There were some of those days in 1944, you still had the open waste windows. And they started to test their guns, and they were all frozen. So they turned around and came home. You can't fly those missions without guns.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was so cold that the guns themselves froze.
Okay, question
that
here.
That leads right into the question I was going to ask. You always hear in accounts about all the challenges of the English weather. Well, for all of you, you hear how challenging the English weather was. My grandfather was there only 4 months, and it was all during the winter. I'm just curious about some of the challenges that particularly the English winter posed in takeoff or landing or on the missions themselves or even just living when you're off mission.
Want me to start? Some of the times when you had in winter time, if you had a fog or something like that, your ice would get on the wings of the airplanes. And you see all these crewmen out there cleaning the wings off, the ice off of the wings. And during the Battle of the Bulge, we couldn't put our hands on the balcony around the control tower because you couldn't get them off. They'd freeze. And we had to put sand on the taxi tracks and make sure the ice was off of the runway and all that sort of stuff. It was quite a lot of work to get these missions off and down safely.
Anybody else? want to respond to that same question?
Did you have de-icing fluids or anything?
There was a de-icer on the plane, yes. Yes, there was a de-icing. But you rarely ever used it.
I have heard that the winter of 43-44, the weather was one of the worst winters in England.
Yeah, that's when he was there.
44-45.
Yeah, 44-45.
44-45, excuse me.
Yeah. It was in December. There were 2 weeks when we couldn't fly.
The ice on the trees was about an inch thick on Third Eye. In the Battle of the Bulge area. The temperature was never above freezing for weeks.
Is there a lot of snow? I'm not familiar with England in the winter.
Frost, mostly.
Fog.
What do you all remember about the British families living around the base? Did any of you have any contact, relationships, that kind of thing?
It's Ralph.
No, we're asking the Americans. We want to know your perceptions, your experiences with the British families. Anybody?
I do.
Well, tell us a little bit about that.
I was sent overseas to become a flying control officer, and I didn't know it. I was sent to a British air base called Abingdon. It wasn't too far from Oxford. It was a British base, and they were sent to a whole group of us, 75 of us were sent over, of which only about 40 of us got a commission. A young man there, a British corporal, same as I was a corporal, stuck his hand out and says, "I'm Cheshire." And he took me home with him the following week. And I had a home there all the time. I was the third son in that family. And I went back in 1968, and the reunion with his mother was something to behold, believe me. She made me an apple pie and everything when I first time I was down there. But it was great. When I had time to get off from the base, I would go down to Surrey and spend a night or two down there. It was a wonderful experience.
I didn't have any contact with family when I was there during the war, but I remember back in 1992 when the 50th anniversary party was held at Third Eye, and my wife and I were there, and they had a dinner in one of the hangars, and there were about 2,500 people there, about 800 of us, including wives, etc., who were in the group during the war, and the rest of them were Brits. And there was a bar that was maybe 50 feet long or so, and the line was about 10 deep waiting to get to the bar to get a drink. And it gave you a chance to talk to the Brits who were there. And I remember distinctly talking to three or four of them. And their approach was they wouldn't let us buy the drink. They insisted on buying the drink for us with the approach that, if it weren't for you guys, we wouldn't be here. And it was, it was just a very rewarding kind of thing to hear somebody, obviously next generation, having that kind of feeling. But the Brits obviously felt very friendly towards the U.S. people.
You've got one in this room right now.
Yes.
Ralph, stand up. Stand up.
I wanted to answer that question about connecting with the British people. The closest big city to Thurlow was the town of Bedford, and almost every night that you wanted to, or at least on weekends, a truck load of GIs would drive in, would be taken into town, and of course the Red Cross was there, and there was always a dance hall. The Corn Tower, was it?
Corn Exchange.
But dances were always going, and there would be the local girls, there would be girls that were part of the, I forgot their titles.
Land girls.
Land army.
Land girls. And so I made some contact with a girl
who we kept coming to the same dances, and eventually she said, well, would you like to come home? And of course I said, I'd be delighted. And she took me to her home, met her folks, and from that time on, I had a place to go. Not that I was there overnight or anything like that, but we always went back to her home and was greeted by her parents, and they really appreciated what we were doing.
We have a comment over here on the first row.
I had two crew members that got real familiar with a couple of the ground crew, and they took a bicycle ride to St. Neots. And after that, we didn't have to worry about getting fresh eggs, which we never got on the base. But these guys would take cigarettes and candy and silk stockings and cosmetics to this farmers and come back with eggs, fresh eggs. And they were good.
Speaking of eggs, some of the farm boys used to come around at night. They come out of the base and they come on with boxes of eggs and things. Because as I understand it, at that time they had to account for all of the agricultural products that they had and turn them in. And if they had an extra egg to someone and then run over to the base. But they'd come out and they'd bang on the barracks door and we'd bring them in. They'd bring them in. I can remember one fellow brought in this thing and there was a nice big egg in there. And I thought, boy, I'll have that one. And I think, a shilling was what, 20 cents, I think, at that time. So, I don't know, we get a couple of eggs for a shilling or something. So I took that. And then you could take them over to the mess hall in the morning, and the cooks would cut them up, cook them up for you. Well, they cooked up this thing, and it came out, it looked off like jelly or something, but it turned out to be a duck egg. It was the worst thing I ever ate.
I know what you mean. I tried one.
You know, he never came back to our barracks. I was looking for him.
Have a question over here?
Now I'm going to tell a story.
Okay.
You asked about the Native people. Ellen, I don't know if you were with me close to us when we went to the last party when we were leaving Thurlai. We're going to go down to southern France. We went to Bedford, and they had a carnival going on there. Were you in that carnival?
No, I don't.
Okay. Anyway, they had a carnival, and we're going down to Istres, closing. We're never going to come back, so we're told. Okay. And so, of course, we're going to have a party. We started the party at the base, and then down there, we kept drinking. And here they had these go-karts that you bump into one another. My navigator and I sat in one, and I'm driving it, banging into people. And finally, they stopped. But he got out, and I went to get out, and a young woman came in and sat down, and she said, okay, take off. I looked at her, and I immediately sensed that this was not the kind of young woman I've met before in Bedford. The only sad thing about it is I was about three sheets to the wind. So I drove the cart, and then we got out. And I said, who are you, after a while? Because I said, I can't place you. She said, I live on an estate. And we used to entertain Americans, and some of you may remember the stories. I heard about it. They would come early in the war. They'd come there and spend weekends and what have you. Well, as time went on, she said, we began to dislike the behavior that we were seeing. You'd spend the weekend with us, and then when we got in Bedford, we'd see you associating with some women we didn't think were up to. I don't recall the words she used, because it was quite interesting. She had, and so she said, we finally closed our estates to you. I had heard earlier that the estates used to be open, and I said, well, what is this that you got in contact with me? And she said, oh, I don't know, I just thought I'd like to talk to an American again, what have you. And so I said, hey, I've got to leave. We're heading for Istres tomorrow morning. And And she said, no problem, I got a car. So she directed me to the car and said, and again, I'm about three sheets to the wind. I was one of these people who didn't show it, but I knew I was smashed. And so she said, here, drive. So I drove back to the base. In fact, went right up to the barracks where we were living. And she said, you know, hey, if you come back again, feel free to come and visit me at the estate. And you don't have to spend time with me if you just want to go out and shoot and walk around and what have you. And so I said goodnight. In the morning I got awake and I said, did that really happen? And I remembered the telephone number that she'd given me. I wrote it on a slip that I had on a wall. A card was there. And we head off in the morning for Esther's and then Africa and what have you. And lo and behold, about a month later, I get set up to take some stuff up to Thurlai from Africa. And to make a long story short, I ended up getting stuck there as the acting squadron commander. Whatever reason Mac did that, I don't know. I think he wanted to get rid of me. Anyway, I immediately rushed up to that barracks, obviously. Nothing on the walls. But I have Major Mac's command car. So I'm out driving around the country seeing if I can remember something. Where the hell did she live? Never did make contact. I ought to talk to Ralph. I never mentioned this to Ralph. He may be able to clue me in who it was that sought me out. But so when it comes to Bedford, there's two stories. That story is one you might want to look into when the estates were open to the people, and eventually they closed them down. I don't know when they were closed down. She didn't tell me. If she told me, hell, I wouldn't remember it anyway, the state I was in. But a very, very interesting aspect of the British. I guess I should make one other comment. I went back here 7 years later with my daughter and my son, and after a while, my son said, Dad, you were a hero. I said, hell, what are you talking about? You know, it seemed like every English who we met would somehow recognize this must be a father with his two children. And they would ask, and I'd say, yeah, I flew here. My goodness, I mean, it was almost embarrassing how graciously they treated us throughout. And wonder, I guess, why not? Hey, remember the German smokes, what was it, 60,000 of the Air Force out of the skies?
Thank you. Thank you so much. We've just got a few minutes. Let's go with Walt, and then we'll go over there.
A little short story. In 2005, VE Day, I won't go into all the other story about this, but I happened to be in the Czech Republic over that VE Day weekend, and I was completely amazed, blown away. I can't describe how those people appreciated Americans, even in 2005. And these were young Europeans, young Czechs, you know, in their teens, 20s, all the way up, everybody. They really did appreciate what happened.
By the way, those of you who saw the earlier session, there's a picture of the pilots giving the parachutes to the local women to use to sew, because it was so hard to come by that fabric. When we were on that trip, a woman, older woman, came walking down this path and sought out Walt, because his brother was one of the ones that died there in that plane crash, and she gave him a piece of the parachute.
Oh.
And I'm almost crying about it now. She said her kids wanted it, but she wanted him to have it. So that shows you the depth of emotion that some of these people still care for what these heroes did.
We've got a question over here, then Bill's got another story. Yes, Cheryl.
I'm just wondering, when did the greatest generation start being called that, and what led to that? I think it's very appropriate.
I didn't quite hear that.
The greatest generation.
When did the name
Foster? How did that come about?
When did you first hear the name greatest generation applied to you?
Oh.
Tom Brokaw's.
I will tell you what I think is American people.
Could you speak
and,
up?
And the British.
We can't hear you.
Can't hear you.
Louder.
I went in, when I went in with the 306 bomb group, we were part of four horsemen, four troops, or four groups that entered England. The corn exchange that they talked about. We used to have a dance in there on Saturday nights, if we were lucky. And later on, when Glenn Miller came in, he would have a, you know, he'd come in and play on Saturday nights. The first night I went in 1942, when I got there, there was a dance. This happened quite often. When you went in, the British soldiers were over here, American soldiers were over here. Girls were kind of down here, but they weren't allowed to dance with us. The rumor was the British boy could buy the girl fish and chips. The American boy could take her out to dinner at a cab. So that's the way it was for a while. And about maybe 3 months when we had been shut down because the casualties were so bad, reorganized and not too much better, but we started flying together. We came back in, I came into a dance, and a woman got up. Because of this stuff was going on, the girls weren't allowed to dance with us. A woman got up, stood up in front of that place, and she says, "You people ought to be ashamed of yourself." She's talking to her own people. "You ought to be ashamed of yourself. These boys are coming back, I've seen them. The blood is running out of them and they're giving it for you." That night, everything changed. After that, you were just as equal as everybody else in that country. Until this day, we are still as equal as we were then. They think as much of us, the 8th Air Force is so loved over there, like I love this guy. And the people, I go back, I actually bought a home over there. I was going to move until I found out my kids were going to send all my grandkids over there. But if anybody ever thinks, don't ever think that there isn't a love with the 8th Air Force and England. Don't ever believe what anybody says about you, about the English people. They are one wonderful country of England.
Bill, okay, we've got Bill next, and then going down the line here.
This is on the lighter side of it. In September 44, the group had been overseas for 2 years, and somebody at the hierarchy decided they would have a party. So they brought in a circus, I guess, had a Ferris wheel and everything else, and everybody was having a ball. But orders came out, and I wish I had kept a copy of those orders. It said, so-and-so, we're going to have this party. There will be no women in the barracks. Next paragraph, there will be no barracks inspection. That's the honest truth.
Okay, down here.
We've talked mostly about bombing missions. We did fly two mercy missions right after the war. And Walt's story about Polkenwald reminded me of it. But we, actually, was a co-pilot for Captain Haas, and we went over to one of these, I don't know which concentration camp it was, but they had made out these pierced plank runways, a runway there. And followed the contour of the land. And there was a pretty exciting landing. What they did was they went into the camp and they took out, we knew them as not as displaced persons, that's what they were called. And we knew nothing about the concentration camps or the horror that went on there. And they brought out, I think, 10 or 12 of the prisoners. And somebody had gotten the idea is that we could transport these prisoners back to the to their home countries and so on. These happened to be French. And put them in a B-17 and fly them down there. We got a lot of 17s. Well, a 17 is not a transport. There's no heat, there's wind blowing through it. It's not a plane you take sick people in. And here we were confronted with 10 or 12 of these people with their tattoos and, as you said, the skinny arms and everything else. And it was the most pitiful thing.
I'd like to give you a...
I've ever seen, and we took it down to France. We flew another one just like that, but they finally had to stop it. Because these people were going to die in that airplane. No way we could do it. So, excuse me.
No, I didn't mean it all right.
No, that's all right.
I wanted just to relay a story of what the U.S. government did following the war for the GIs that were still there and hadn't earned enough points to go home. I was one of those that had the opportunity to go to college. Sydenham University in southern England was a place where the government brought American professors to provide a college opportunity for any GI who wanted to sign up to do that. And I was on one of those groups that was doing the photo missions. And when this came through, I quickly signed up and was fortunate enough to be chosen. So I went to Sydenham University, got my first semester of college education right here in England. And I can only thank the U.S. government for putting that together.
Anything else as we close? Let's thank our panel, a great panel. We'll have one more of these, 3:45 Saturday afternoon, so we hope you'll rejoin us. We've got another slate of veterans for another round table.
Nice job.
Nice job.
Downstairs.